Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
Another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it is the long-awaited episode. This episode is the long-awaited episode where we will discuss a game that we have teased since the beginning of 2021.
Yeah, that's like a month
Matthew,
ago.
What game are we talking about today?
We're talking about Architects of the West Kingdom, designed by Shem Phillips and S.J. McDonald, and published in 2018 by Garpil Games. It was nominated for a lot of things, including Golden Geek Game of the Year and Kennerspiel. And I want to mention that this is part of a sort of like shared universe or
a saga
of games involving cardinal directions.
Yes.
There's like Raiders of the North Sea, for example.
Right. But this game, I mean, from what I can tell, the games in this series all have different mechanics and goals and themes, slightly different themes, I guess. Technically, they all take place in the same time period in the same shared universe. But this game, Architects of the West Kingdom, is a worker placement game, which sets it apart from the other games in the series, as well as other worker placement games, as we get into the details here. So shall I get into a short description of the game?
Yeah.
All right. So for a short description on what Architects of the West Kingdom is, in Architects, as I will shorten it from here on out, players attempt to curry the favor of the king by constructing buildings and progressing work on the cathedral in his kingdom, all while carefully managing their virtue. Plenty opportunities exist for players to get ahead while skirting the laws, but get too careless and you'll accumulate debt and negative points. After all spaces in the guild hall have been filled by workers, players calculate their victory points earned or lost by their virtue, buildings built, cathedral progress, debt, workers in jail, and resources. The player with the most points at the end of the game wins. So it's a worker placement game where you earn victory points by performing certain actions, and other actions will potentially lose you victory points by the end of the game. And the player with the most points wins. And there's a theme in this game of like either being a goody two shoes or playing risky and against the law to get ahead. But the ultimate goal is to earn victory points. So let's get a little further into the details of how to play this game and then talk about the strategy, and then we'll talk about the design.
All right.
I think the first thing that should be stated is that this is a worker placement game, but it plays a lot different, very differently from how other worker placement games are played. So if you're familiar with other worker placement games, each player has a limited number of workers. There are spaces on the board. Players play their workers on the spaces, typically in a first come, first serve fashion. And so there is a emphasis on taking priority spaces with your workers before other players take them. And then there's usually a point in the game, usually like at the end of a round, where everyone takes their workers back and the board resets in a way. This is the same for like Agricola or Lords of Waterdeep or Viticulture. This game, however, does not have that sort of return your workers phase. Instead, your workers just stay on the board, and certain actions that you or your opponents can take will remove them from the board and place them either back into your supply of workers or into a sort of like holding cell where you'll have to release them from. And additionally, a lot of worker placement games have an emphasis on there being a limited number of workers and there being a mechanic for you to add workers to your worker pool, thereby giving you more turns or more actions in a round or more actions in a turn. This game, however, everyone starts the game with the same number of workers, which happens to be quite a large number. I believe it's
20.
Yes, 20 workers. And this number stays static for the whole game. You can lose workers in a way because there are some places where you place your workers where they do not return for the rest of the game. They're stuck there for the rest of the game. So your number of workers can go down, but it never goes up. And I guess the last thing to point out is most of the spaces in this game where you place your workers, you're meant to place multiple workers you and your opponents can play your workers there. So there's no like first come, first serve mechanic that many other worker games have. So this is a worker placement game that that reexamines the rules of worker placement game to make it something very unique and interesting.
Right. I guess it's worth noting that pretty much every space has a benefit for playing multiple workers on it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So like for the core resource spaces, it'll give you like a resource per worker, like a wood per worker of yours you have on mm-hmm. that space, or mm-hmm. a stone per worker on that space.
Right. On your turn, you only place one worker someplace, but if you already have workers there, then you'll get a higher bonus when you place your worker there, like you explained.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start at the setup of the game. So every player is dealt a little player card that has a color associated with it. That player gets all of the workers of that associated color, and they place a token on the virtue track. They place their token in the center of the virtue track, I believe at the 7 space. Yes, at 7 virtue. It goes from 0 to 14. And then players also place another token at the bottom of the cathedral progress tracker. And players will move their token up on the cathedral progress tracker when they take the action to do so at the cost of resources to earn points by the end of the game and other benefits. Okay, so after everyone's been dealt all their pieces, and then everyone is dealt 4 building cards, and players draft 3 of these building cards, taking one, passing the rest until one of the cards is left. They go on the bottom of the building deck. Building cards are one of the primary ways to earn points. I would say the other 2 ways to earn points are progressing on the cathedral tracker and having a higher virtue at the end of the game. Buildings have a resource cost, and we'll get into what the resources are in a moment. Occasionally, they'll have a assistant skill prerequisite, and we'll explain what that means in a moment. They also will usually have a immediate effect or a end of game effect that could earn you bonus points or bonus virtue or give you resources when they're constructed. And then each building is worth a number of points, usually somewhere between like 5 and 11, depending on how many resources or how complicated the building is to play.
Right. Maybe like 6 on average.
So there's building cards. There is the assistant cards, which fill up a sort of assistant trade row. The assistants have skills associated with them, which fill the prerequisites for building most buildings. Those 3 skills are carpentry, tiling, and masonry. And certain buildings will require those skills, which means you just have to have bought one of those assistants during the game. After you purchase an assistant, you just have it for the rest of the game. Assistants also give you added benefits for certain spaces on the board. So like, for example, there's a stoneworker assistant who is probably a mason, and they will give you bonus rock resources when you go to the quarry.
Right. Some of them...
There's also... Go ahead.
I was going to say, some of them give you alternate actions you can take on certain spaces as well. Mm-hmm. And you can only have at most 5 assistants.
Yes. Some of them have a sort of good or bad virtue theme to them. So like there's certain assistants that will gain you virtue when you acquire them, and they will also give you benefits when you work on the cathedral, which this game considers to be a virtuous action. Other assistants will lose you virtue, but they will make it easier for you to access the black market, which is a not so virtuous action in this game.
Right.
So after everyone's been or everyone's chosen their buildings and a starting player is determined, everyone is dealt silver as the sort of money resource in this game. You get a different amount of silver depending on what your starting position is. And then players just begin taking turns, placing workers out. At the beginning of a player's turn, if they don't have any workers in their supply, then they must spend their whole turn returning one single worker from anywhere on the board to their supply, except for from the guild hall, which is the only place workers can permanently stay. So players just take turns placing one worker at a time and performing whatever actions that worker does. The goal of the game is obviously to earn these points from building buildings, progressing on the cathedral, and gaining
virtue.
Virtue, And the way that you build buildings and progress in the cathedral is by playing workers in the guild hall. But before you can do that, you obviously need to collect resources.
Right. So I guess let's talk about those.
Sure.
The quarry and the lumber mill, I think it is. Or is it the forest?
Let me double check that. It's one or the other. It's the forest.
Okay, yeah. So the quarry and the forest will give you one of their respective resource per worker on it. So one for the first, two for the second, so forth.
And they give you stone and wood.
Right.
If it wasn't obvious.
The mine, I believe it's called,
yeah,
gives you a brick plus a brick for every worker on that space, or it'll give you a gold for every pair of workers on the space.
Mm-hmm. That is gold is one of the premium resources in this game, which means it's worth 1 point at the end of the game per gold you have.
Right.
When you play a worker on the mines, you have to choose one resource or the other to obtain, and you only get that resource. So other actions that we explain later on will have multiple or other spaces we explain will have multiple actions to them, and you'll be able to split up which actions you take per worker on that space. But for the mines, all of your workers have to take the same action, which is, again, to either take one brick plus one per worker or one gold per two workers.
Right. There is one more, like, basic resource space, which is the silversmith, which just gives you one silver plus one for every worker on the silversmith.
Yeah. And the silver coins, again, is like the money resource, and you spend it in different ways, chiefly to acquire assistance.
Right.
So let's go into that. So assistance, there's one space in the bottom of the board called the workshop, which has two actions associated with it. Similar to the mines, you have to choose one and take only that action. So the first action is you pay 4 silver, 2 of which is tax. We'll explain what that means in a moment. You pay 4 silver and you acquire an assistant. And depending on how many workers you have at the workshop when you take this action, that'll determine where in the trade row you can acquire your assistant from. So they're sort of 4 columns of two rows each. And you choose which column you buy from based on how many, or you can, which columns you can buy from based on how many assistants you have.
Right. So if you have
one assistant, you can only buy from the first column. 2 assistants means you can buy from the first and second column, and so on. This game allows you to skip columns by paying an extra silver onto the assistant in the column that you skipped over. So, like, if you play one assistant, but you want to buy, or one worker, but you want to buy an assistant from the second column, you have to put a silver on the assistant in the first column that you are skipping over.
And then whoever buys that assistant gets that silver.
Right. The other action you can take at the workshop is, instead, you can draw one building card plus an additional building card per 2 workers on the workshop.
Right. It's a little slower of a growth than other spaces. Also, you can only have at most 5 building cards in your hand, but you can build as many buildings as you want.
Right.
There is one more premium resource we didn't mention, which is marble. Yeah. And you
acquire that at the King's Storehouse, by the way.
Right. The King's Storehouse is one of the spaces where you can split up your actions.
Mm-hmm.
The way it works is, when you place a worker on it, you can take 1 of 2 actions for each worker you have. And so each worker can take a different action. That is either trade 2 stone, brick, or wood for 1 virtue, or trade, I believe, 3 wood or 3 stone for a marble.
Or rather, 2 in any combination wood, brick, and stone, or 3 in any combination of wood and stone for a marble. Yeah, so this is one of the only ways to acquire marble in the game. And like you said, this action, you can take different actions with each worker you have here when you play a worker here. So like, if you play your second worker in the King's Storehouse, you can use the first worker to spend 2 brick for a virtue, and then the second worker can instead spend like 2 wood and a stone for a marble.
Right.
Certain assistants.
Yeah.
Oh, I assume you're about to go this way too. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
There are a lot of assistants that are merchants, and these merchants will give you an alternate action you can take at the King's Storehouse, where you spend a resource to get another resource. instead of just the two that are on the board.
Right.
But these are still a different action you take. It's not free.
Okay. The next space we can describe is the tax stand. So like I mentioned, when you buy an assistant and when you perform a couple other different actions in this game, two or some or more of your money is taxed, which means that rather than going back to just the general supply when you pay it, it instead goes to the tax stand, which is a space on the board. And you can place a worker at the tax stand and lose two virtue to take all of the tax money in the tax stand, which can grow to a pretty sizable amount over the course of a game at various points over the course of a game.
Right.
The next space I want to describe is the black market. So the black market is one of the only spaces on the board where space is limited and it is first come, first serve. There are three spaces in the black market. Each one costs more silver than the next. So the first space costs one silver, second space costs two, and the third costs three. Each space also will lose you one virtue if you place a worker there. The first space will generally cost a silver and a virtue and give you a luxury resource plus one resource of another kind. The second space allows you to acquire any assistant from anywhere in the assistant trade row, regardless of its column. Or it lets you draw five building cards and keep one, putting the rest on the bottom of the deck. The third space costs three silver, one virtue, and it generally gives you two luxury resources and two other resources.
When the game starts, this third space will give you two marble, and then I believe a wood and a stone.
Correct.
But that changes whenever there are three workers in the black market.
Right. That's called a black market reset, and I want to go into that right after I describe what the guild hall is about.
Okay,
so the guild hall has a limited number of spaces. Each space is like the silhouette of your worker, and when you play a worker here, you lay it down flat in one of these spaces, starting in the top left corner and moving from left to right and top to bottom. Certain spaces are included or excluded from a game, depending on how many players are playing. So once all of the spaces that are allowed for the game have been filled up, that signals the end of the game. So this is the timer for the game. When you play a worker in the guild hall, you choose to either build a building or progress on the cathedral. If you build a building, then you just have to pay whatever resources are listed on the building that you are attempting to build. You also have to have the prerequisite skills on your assistants, if there are any. Then you play your building, and you gain any of its immediate effects, and at the end of the game, you'll score points from it. If you choose to progress on the guild hall, on the cathedral, you must pay the resource listed on the next level of the cathedral. There are five levels with increasingly difficult costs to pay. Each level will, in addition to resources, will also cost you discarding one building card. Then you get to move your pawn up on the tracker of the cathedral, and at the end of the game, you'll get points based on where you end on this tracker. And you'll also get to draw a favor card, which will give you some virtue plus some other resources. In addition, this cathedral space is a first-come, first-serve tracker. There's limited space as you progress up it. So, for example, there's only three spaces on the first level, which means that if three other players are in the first level of the cathedral tracker, a fourth player could not advance to that level until space has been made by one of those three players moving to the second level. And the very topmost level, which gives you 20 points if you manage to reach it, only has one space. So only one player can reach the top level of the cathedral in any given game of Architects. All right, now, two locations on the guild hall, when they are filled by a worker, cause a black market reset, which is the same thing that happens when all three spaces on the black market get filled up by workers. So in a black market reset, first of all of the workers in the black market go to jail, which is the final space on the board that we haven't described yet, but we will describe it very soon. And then depending on how many workers are in jail, for each given player, players may lose virtue or gain debt. And then there's a deck of cards in the cheap slot of the black market. You take the card that's on the top of it, which lists, you know, those one or two luxury resources, flip it over and put it in the third slot of the black market. And this will change what resources you can acquire at those two spaces on the black market. So again, that happens twice over the course of a game when certain spaces in the guild hall are filled, and also every time the black market gets filled up, all three spaces.
Okay.
Okay. So finally, we need to talk about the guardhouse.
Well, hold on.
Oh, go ahead.
First, we need to talk about the town center.
Oh, right. I forgot about the town center.
So the town center, when you place a worker on it, you get to capture workers on a space. Mm-hmm. The first time you do this, it costs a tax, a silver tax. But if you have more workers, you can spend more money, but everything after the first one is not taxed.
Mm-hmm.
Once you spend your money, you choose a space on the board, and you take all of one player's workers from that space and put them in your holding on your player tableau.
Mm-hmm.
And then, or if you choose your own workers, you just put them in your supply.
Right, your own personal supply of workers.
Right. If you have multiple workers on the town center and you spend multiple silver, then you can take more than one player's workers from one space. On three players or fewer, you can choose up to two different spaces, but mm-hmm. on four or five workers, you can only choose one space to take from.
Or in a four or five player game.
That's what I meant, four or five players.
Right. You can only select one space to take workers from.
Right.
And yeah, each silver you spend is, like you said, for acquiring one player's workers, all of one player's workers from one space.
Right.
Okay, so that's important. So when you go to the town center, you either take your workers back. This is one of the two ways to get, or one of the three ways to get your workers back. But you also capture other players' workers, and you put them in your own personal, like, holding cell on your player placard. So the reason why you do that is because of the last space in this game, which is the guardhouse. So at the guardhouse, you take one action per worker you have there. There are four different actions you can take here, and you take them in any combination, but usually it's pretty self-explanatory which actions you should take whenever you go here. So the first action described in the guardhouse is that you can deposit all of the workers you have captured from other players into jail and gain one silver per worker you deposit. So if you have seven workers captured, three from one player, four from another, whatever combination, and you go here and you put them in jail, you get seven silver, which is a pretty decent chunk of change.
Get a chunk of change.
The second action you can take is you can retrieve all of your workers from jail and put them into your personal supply. So this is one of the other ways to get your workers back. The third action is you can pay five silver, two of which is taxed, or you can acquire a debt and a negative virtue. So there's two different costs to this action. But when you take this action and you pay the cost, whichever cost you choose, you get to take all of your workers that are currently being held by other players on their placards. So if other players are keeping a lot of your workers captive, you can use this action to grab them before they go to jail. And then the final action you can take at the guardhouse is you can pay six silver, three of which is taxed, to pay off a debt. So like we've mentioned, there's a couple different ways to get debts, such as the third action at the guardhouse. So this is one of the only ways that you can pay them off. Paying off a debt, by the way, I should mention, are worth negative 2 points at the end of the game. And when you pay them off, not only do you not lose those points, but you also get a virtue.
Yes.
Okay. And when the black market resets and there are workers in jail, the player with the most workers in jail gets a debt. And anyone who has at least three workers in jail loses a virtue. And also, it should be mentioned that at the end of the game, you lose 2 points for every, or sorry, you lose 1 point for every pair of workers in jail.
Yes. There is, I don't think we really mentioned what the virtue tracker does.
No, beyond I was going to head there next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
okay, so go ahead.
At the end of the game, if you are high up on the virtue tracker, you get points based on how high you are.
Right.
If you are.
So I should say you start at seven. Once you get to 10 virtue, you start to earn points. Everything from 6 to 9 does not change your point total at the end of the game. But 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 earn you increasing amounts of points at the end of the game.
Right. And then everything below 6 will give you negative points at the end of the game, mm-hmm. all the way to 0. If you gain virtue and you are already at the highest virtue, you pay off a debt for free. If you lose virtue and you're already at the lowest virtue, you gain a debt.
Mm-hmm.
Then, if you are above 9 virtue, you cannot go to the black market. And if you are below 6 virtue, you cannot build on the cathedral.
Sorry, it's below 4 virtue. Or below 5 virtue.
Sorry.
4 or fewer, you can't build on the
cathedral. Okay. And then, lastly, if you are low on virtue, you pay less taxes.
Yes.
I believe it's... is it 4 and 3? Or minus 1?
At 3 and 2, okay. You pay 1 fewer taxes. And at 1 and 0, you pay 2 fewer taxes.
Yes.
So, for example, if you're at 1 virtue, when you go to the guardhouse to pay off a debt, you only have to pay 4 silver rather than 6 because you get to skimp on 2 of those taxed silver.
Right. And if you're at 1 and you go to the tax collection, you'll get a debt. That's the point.
So from that, it can be seen that, like, at a higher virtue, you can no longer go to the black market, which is one of the easiest places to acquire luxury resources.
And to get specific buildings.
Yeah. So there's a trade-off to having high virtue. And then similarly for low virtue, at a certain point, you can't progress on the cathedral, so you lose out on one of the 3 ways of getting victory points at the end of the game.
And you lose out on the most consistent method of getting, well, not the most, but one of the more consistent methods of getting virtue.
Yes.
Comes harder to pay off your rewards, moral debt.
Yes. But eventually you also get to skip on paying taxes, which could make your turns more efficient depending on what kinds of actions you'd like to take.
And I think with that, we can do strategy.
Yes. Okay. So I think when we start talking about strategy, I like to start with describing the 2 sort of points of forming your strategy for the rest of the game. Like, there's sort of 2 things that happen at the beginning of the game that you can form the rest of your strategy around. The first is the buildings that you draft at the start of the game. There are some buildings that require 1 or fewer assistants, which can be built early or can be built anytime throughout the game without having to worry about what assistance. So one strategy at the beginning of the game is to take very easy to build buildings and dump them out really quick. Another strategy is that some buildings can be chained into other buildings. For example, there's a building that gives you 2 marble after you build it, and then you might have another building that requires 2 marble to be built. So rather than having to waste a lot of time collecting resources and converting them to marble, these 2 buildings can sort of chain one into the other and be a very efficient turn 2 or 2 turn combo.
Right.
The last point I would make about drafting buildings is that some buildings serve as build-arounds, building-arounds, that will sort of give you a direction for the rest of the game. Like, there's buildings that say they'll give you bonus virtue at the end of the game if you have the most brick, or they'll give you bonus points if you have 0 debts. Going for build-arounds is a fine strategy, but if you do, it's beneficial that your other buildings sort of play into the same strategy. So, for example, if you get the college, which gives you bonus points if you have 0 debt at the end of the game, it helps to also draft the building that can pay off one of your debts for free when it's built.
By the way, that's a very cheeky joke, by the way.
Yeah, it's a very clever card. Like, you get benefits from it, from the college, if you don't have any debts at the end. By the way, I want to say finally, because how your workers, like, sort of multiplicatively work together, it's more difficult to have a diverse amount of resources. So, like, focusing on 2 resources, it will end up with more resources per turn than if you were focusing on 3. So it helps to have multiple buildings that require the same kinds of resources.
Right. My other point is you don't want all 3 of your buildings to require the same skill. I don't think. Well, it might seem counterintuitive because you might be like, oh, then I just need one assistant. But I think the problem is that you can't easily guarantee that you'll get the exact skill you need at the exact time you need it.
Yeah.
We played a game yesterday and one of the players did not get the skill they needed for like 10 turns.
Right. Yeah. Because of
probably abnormal, but in a larger player game, people might just buy them before you do.
Right. It because of the nature of the assistant trade row, it can be hard to get one assistant of every skill. So yeah, it helps to diversify those. I'd say the resources are easy to specialize in, so you don't need to diversify what resources you'll need to build buildings. Diversifying your skills required is a good thing. I think the chain, like the building combos, is the best way to go rather than build arounds or cheap building.
There are some build arounds that I think work really well. The ones that give you points for having the most of a resource kind of already reward you for doing something good, which is to specialize resources. And they tend to synergize with certain assistants really well.
Mm-hmm. I think I want to play this game. I'd like to play this game more to see if the bonus virtue buildings work, because the last time we played, I ended up having like max virtue for most of the game. So these like bonus virtue buildings didn't do much for me. But maybe, you know, if you're planning on building these buildings that will give you virtue at the end of the game, you can play a little looser with how much virtue you have throughout the game.
Right.
I don't know. That might be too many maybes to be a solid strategy for a whole game.
It should be noted that every player tableau has a flip side that has its own unique starting values and its own unique ability.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the flip sides starts at a different virtue value. And one of them starts at negative virtue. Or not negative, but low virtue.
Yeah, it starts at like 4.
And so when I got that, I kind of wanted to build buildings with extra virtue so I could get out of that hole a little easier. Sure. I also think there's a building card called Aqueducts that gives you a point for every building you've built at the end of the game. And that synergizes really well with the building combo buildings and the buildings that don't require a given skill, because those tend to be really cheap.
Yeah.
I think that's a good build around.
For sure. I only bring up the virtue gaining buildings because there's sort of like a difference between buildings that give you virtue at the end of the game versus buildings that give you points at the end of the game. I meant to say that like I don't think the virtue gaining buildings are that good, because I feel like the point gaining buildings are better.
Right.
If it gives you anything at the end of the game, I'd prefer it just gave me flat out points rather than virtue. But that said, a clever player who's good at managing their virtue might be able to play a little more efficiently, knowing that they'll get a little extra virtue at the end of the game.
Right. So as far as assistants go.
Yeah. And by the way, this is the second strategy point. The first point is what buildings you draft. And then the second point is what assistants you buy.
Right. You want to look at those first 8 and, you know, think about like a good 2 or 3 that are good or useful. You know, make sure that you have backup plans for if one of them gets bought. Especially the ones in the first 2 columns, because those are the cheapest to get. I think for me, it feels like assistants are better spent working towards your engine than they are just for the skill. Like, if you need a specific skill and it's easy to get it, that's fine. But it always felt to me like the assistants that improve your engine are better.
How would you explain an assistant that improves your engine?
So, yeah. Like, there are ones that just give you an extra resource when you go to a resource space, like the woodcutter gives you an extra wood when you visit the forest. There are some, like, there's some that make the black market cost less money. These are all ones where, like, you're investing resources into them, but it gives you resources as the game progresses. And this is a game where the rate you get resources is really important. Because for one thing, people will steal your workers, so you can't easily get like more than 3 or 4 of a resource in one turn. So like Woodcutter helps with that by giving you extra wood. And then also, since the guild hall is first come, first serve, you want to be using that as much as possible. Or rather, you want to be the person who uses the guild hall the most.
Mm-hmm.
Or else you're missing out on opportunity to build buildings. And so having extra resource gain or like a better resource, you know, management means that you're spending less time on resource spaces and more time building buildings.
Right.
Or using the chapel. So yeah,
I agree with your points on assistance. I put it that you want to get, you know, however many assistants you need to build the priority buildings in your hand based on their skills. So that's important. And then the second way you can look at assistance is whether they increase your production, like you said, especially if they increase production on a thing that you need. Like if you have a lot of buildings that require stone, getting the stonemason is very important. But then also it helps to get assistants that synergize with one another. So getting like multiple acolytes, which give you benefits for going to the cathedral, or having multiple like black market dealers, which give you bonuses for going to the black market. It helps if your assistants work together that way. And then I think the third option is it helps when they can provide a useful action at, you know, someplace like the storehouse, the king's storehouse. But those ones that provide useful actions at the king's storehouse are ones that don't actually need to be bought early in the game. If you think of it like the stonemason or somebody that lets you skip on paying costs or give you bonuses for performing certain actions throughout the course of the game, they have like an infinitely high ceiling for how much value they can generate. But the ones that give you bonus actions don't have that sort of value ceiling or lack thereof.
Right.
If that makes sense. Like one guy can provide so much bonus resources for you. Another one would just give you the option to like spend money at this place to get resources. That one doesn't have a ceiling.
I will say that merchants are one of the few ways to convert money into buildings. Mm-hmm. Silver is usually used on buying assistance, doing things in the black market, paying off debts, and then town center.
Right.
But no buildings have a silver cost. And I don't think the cathedral does either.
It does not.
So, like, one of the few ways to actually convert money into resources for those is merchants.
Mm-hmm. So if you see yourself getting a lot of money, or I think it might be just a general rule of thumb that it's good to get one merchant, over the course of the game. But I wouldn't prioritize them first. I would definitely prioritize getting those assistants that can have like a lot of value, that can generate a lot of value over the course of the game and help feed into your engine.
Yes. I want to ask what you think about the chapel as a victory condition, or like whether that's a strategy.
You mean the cathedral?
Yeah, cathedral.
Yes. So looking at the numbers, it doesn't really add up. So like a building alone can be worth just like 7 points. Like a pretty easy to build building can be worth 7 points. You have to get to the third level of the cathedral, which at this point has cost you 4 stone and wood in some combination, a gold and a marble, which is sort of like a generic building cost. But it took you 3 turns and 3 building cards to do that.
And 3 workers.
And 3 workers. So it doesn't the cathedral doesn't really get really worth it until you get to the fourth level, which jumps from 7 points to 12 points, which is a 5-point jump, which is about the cost of a building. And then 12 to 20, which is the highest level, is an 8-point jump, which is, again, about the cost of a building. But that it took so long to get there that the cathedral doesn't really make a lot of sense as your primary point source. Like,
yeah.
You'll probably still score most of your points from your buildings. That said, the cathedral is the less risky option if you're going between like being a good natured person and a bad natured person in this game. You don't have to worry about getting debts if you're going this way, because your virtue will be high just as a result in general. And it has to be high, at least, so that you can go to the cathedral. And by going to the cathedral, you may be gaining virtue that gives you points on the virtue tracker. So, like, you may go from 4 to 7 points, which is only a 3-point gain, which is less than a building on average. But that might take you from 12 to 13 virtue, which is a 2-point gain, which comes out to 5 points in the end.
It is worth noting that the favor cards can give you stone, wood, and I think marble.
Right.
Most of them give you some sort of resource along with virtue.
Yeah, they can give you basic resources. They can occasionally give you rare resources. Sometimes they just let you draw another building card, or they let you get some silver. They might give you some silver. Each one of them will give you a virtue, though. I think the cathedral is probably best focused when you have either the building that cares that you have the highest position on the cathedral for extra bonus points at the end of the game, I think, or whether you have like two of those assistants that give you bonuses from working on the cathedral.
Right.
You need to be getting enough back from the cathedral that it makes sense for you to be getting less points than average than a building would. Either you're getting like more resources back, meaning you're paying fewer resources for a building that is worth fewer points, which ends up coming out to be like even in terms of tempo and value, or maybe it's feeding into a different strategy. So it's synergizing with something else you have available.
Right. I was going to say there is one flip side, like one special ability on the back sides of the tableaus that does give you benefits for using the cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it circumvents the building cost, like discarding a building card.
Yeah, it keeps you from having to discard a building. I think if anything, if you at least have the assistant that returns a building to your hand, or that lets you draw a building after you use the cathedral, thereby like nullifying that building card cost of the cathedral, that could make it at least about worth it,
right,
to go there. Okay, but like we said, the way that the points work out with the cathedral, you do need to get like to the fourth level at least for it to somewhat make sense.
Right. I have two more strategy notes that are kind of tied together.
Mm-hmm.
The first is, I don't think you want to be the first person to use the town center. The town center by itself is low tempo because it doesn't give you any immediate benefit. It requires another turn to actually get a resource out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the turn you use the town center, everybody else can use a resource space. Now, here's sort of the hypothetical. Let's say everybody is focusing on two resources. So everybody's placed two workers on two resource spots. The first person to use the town center will get two workers from somebody else, which will be two silver. The second person to use it will get three workers from somebody else, because by then everybody would have had another turn around, and they would have placed extra workers. And they would have gotten three resources out of that. So, like, it's sort of like a game of chicken, almost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you wait longer for more people to place workers and thus get better value out of your town center? Or do you just place more workers and risk more people taking workers before you do? Now, with that being said, if you have the option to place a fourth worker somewhere or wait for the three workers on that space to get captured and then place the worker, I'm pretty sure it's better to just place the fourth worker. Because I'm pretty sure the surplus of resources is better than the extra worker that would be captured.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like,
I think
it takes two turns to get three wood, let's say. If you have three workers on wood and you need two for a building, playing a worker as the fourth worker there gives you four, which gives you a surplus of two wood that can be spent on some other building or the chapel or what have you. If you wait, then you have to spend two turns to get the wood instead of one, and you only have one surplus.
Mm-hmm.
And then meanwhile, you can get you can spend one worker to get three workers from the guardhouse, but you can also get four workers just as easily. So, like, it doesn't matter how many workers you have in the guardhouse if you're going to get them back anyways.
Mm-hmm. I think, so, like, there's a lot of math you can do to decide, like, when it's opportune to play a worker on the town center and collect workers. I think from what we've seen, generally, like, playing one worker to acquire at least four of someone else's workers is something to keep an eye out for. That's when it feels like it's starting to become more worth it. This is all dependent on how much money you think you need, though. But at least four workers means that you have enough money to buy an assistant, right, when you deposit them in jail. So I think that's where four comes from there. And then similarly, it's okay to play your first worker there if you are trying to pick up your own workers from a space. And I think three is the minimum when you would consider doing that, because it's like not as so appetizing that somebody else would want to take them to put them in jail, but maybe appetizing enough if there's a second group that they're planning to take. But at least you're not like going like one for two, like one turn to get two more turns.
Right, you're only getting plus one if you do that.
Yeah, and it feels better to get at least three workers with a worker. I think I enjoy using my first worker at the town center to get my own workers back, and then using my second worker to get two groups of workers from another space. That means I'm probably getting like five silver or something.
Right.
Five to seven. I think certain people will be incentivized to use the town center if they get discounts on taxed silver or non-taxed silver.
Right. Yeah.
Which can come from assistance or special abilities from the backside of cards.
Or low virtue.
Yes. So the only other strategy points I have to make is like pay attention to the jail, especially when black market resets are looming. Just make sure that you are taking calculated risks. You have three, you know, in there, and you know you have three, and you're fine with losing a virtue, or you know, you notice that you have the most, or you will have the most during a black market reset. So maybe you take a little extra precaution at that time. Whether or not you think you can manage the debt. From after the point where you get assistance, it's mostly just about collecting resources and periodically taking actions that score you points, whether that's playing buildings or advancing on the cathedral. And then towards the end of the game, as you're finishing your last few buildings or the cathedral progressions that you're aiming for, and you'll know the feeling that it's close to the end of the game, because you'll see the guild hall is almost filled up. I think while you balance between like finishing your last few buildings and such, it's also important to aim to maximize your virtue by the end of the game, or aim to get as much luxury resources as you can. Just because like those are the other two ways to earn those last few points for the end of the game.
Yeah.
Do you have any more strategy points?
Nope.
All right. So before we get into the design discussion, we have a couple quick plugs. You can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. Hit us with a follow and suggestions for games you'd like to hear us talk about. We welcome all suggestions. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have our episodes posted and cataloged. So if you're looking for an episode where we discuss a specific game, you can find it by looking through our tags there. You can also find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/user/bgbcast, where we have our cool merch with our cool logo on it. That's mostly it for BG Bros plugs, so let's hear from Matt plugs.
You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming. I tweet about the stuff I work on and the stuff I do, which is quite a lot. For example, I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak, and I stream on Monday, Wednesday, Friday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I recently played through the Hitman World of Assassination trilogy, which was great. You can find the highlights of the first level of that on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/IEatAtSonic. That's IEATATSONIC. I also make video essays and reviews there. You can also check out my other podcast, Net Surfer Pro. a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web, where me and my friend Galen talk about interesting media from the last 20 years. Today we are we're releasing an episode about the Stanley Parable, a fun video game.
Mm-hmm. Definitely check out Net Surfer Pro.
Yeah.
But you can follow me at Jeff Craig Designs on Twitter. Mostly like tweets that make me laugh.
Nice.
All right. So let's talk about the design of the game.
Okay.
Before we get into the board layout, which is superb, I do want to say, I mean, we have to talk about how this game switches up the worker placement genre.
Yes. So I want to say there's sort of a general piece of advice, which is design a game around a theme, mechanic, component, or moment. I'm the one who added the word moment. I think it fits with games like The Mind.
Mm-hmm.
This is the prime example of a game being built around a mechanic. It is built entirely around the one twist on worker placement.
Mm-hmm.
The system of having all your workers at the start, and you don't retrieve workers. Normally, you have to pay to capture them, but you can capture opponents' workers and sell them to get resources.
Mm-hmm.
Every other decision is built to facilitate that. So, like, stacking workers gives depth to capturing in that sort of game of chicken sense. So spaces are designed to reward capturing workers. I mean, are designed to reward stacking workers to then capture. Mm-hmm. The black market interacts with the selling mechanic by adding risk to leaving workers in the jail. There is an element of risk in that, like, putting workers on the guild hall loses workers permanently, which means that you have to manage your workers more carefully as the game progresses. Not only does the guild hall reset the black market, but it leaves you with fewer total workers in play.
Mm-hmm. And this one's pretty subtle. Like, you don't really notice the squeeze that placing your workers in the guild hall has on your actions until you're, like, in the later stages of the game and you're realizing you have to take your workers back more and more. And also, the workers that haven't been taken back are just spread so thin. Like, you just have one or two workers at a couple random places, like the workshop or the tax stand.
Right. The fact that there are three main resource spots, and you usually generally focus on two, pretty much means that you're going to be clustered around two resources at a time, which, again, adds value to capturing. So yeah, it's like, like I said, it's entirely built around this mechanic in a way that's very central. There aren't many unique paths to victory. It's not a build game where you plan out a specific strategy. It's very kind of by the books. Like, everybody's doing pretty much the same thing.
But well, I think there is the dichotomy between being virtuous and being not virtuous.
Sure.
That you can sort of attempt with or differentiate different strategies with.
Sure.
And being less virtuous means you're playing with just more risk, but greater efficiency with your turns.
Right. But I think it doesn't need to have all these different build orders or paths to victory, because the core mechanics are so tight. Right. It's like it puts all its eggs in one basket, but it focuses on making that basket as stable as possible.
Right. And it's also very smart that it's this basket that is this twist on a common genre.
Right.
It's nice that it found its, like, unique vision and niche in board gaming. And it made a twist on a very common thing that a lot of board gamers are familiar with. It's a good idea to place your bet on that sort of a concept.
Right. It's worth noting that many worker placement games have indirect conflict by making spaces first come, first serve and having limited resources. Architects is almost the exact opposite. Spaces are unlimited. They have unlimited resources. But you do have direct conflict by capturing specific players' workers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't count the number of times where I thought, oh, they are getting a lot of resources. I need to slow them down to the town center.
But an interesting point about that in this game is that the direct conflict doesn't feel like direct conflict per se, because they're almost doing a service to you in a way, or right. at least something about a player picking your pieces off the board and putting them in jail. There's some benefit to you because now they've all been gathered up in one place, and it's only going to take one action for you to take them all back. And no resources. It's free to take them out of jail.
Right. It doesn't super punish you for getting your worker stolen, mm-hmm. which means that it's sort of guilt-free to target a player. Like, sure, you can target somebody who's ahead, and it'll hurt them for the moment, but they can get those workers back easily. So it's right. like no hard feelings.
Yeah, if anything, once they get those workers back, they can just do whatever they were doing with them again. So like if they didn't get enough wood, they can get those workers back and use those workers to get the wood that they're missing still. So it's like it kind of comes back around and pays you back in a way.
Right. I think theoretically, if you had infinite time, you could just get all 20 of your workers back if you didn't put any of them in the guild hall. But at the same time, the fact that the guild hall is sort of a malleable timer that the players determine, but it can never tick backwards, means that there is a timer, and so there is tension in not, you know, there is mm-hmm. a reason to quickly capture workers versus, you know, why would you capture workers if they can just take them back from the base and then build and then get resources again? It's because there's a timer.
Mm-hmm. I love that this game employs sort of like now a modern aspect of game design, which is this sort of like free flowing turn structure where there really are no turns or rounds to the game.
Well, there are turns.
But I mean, there's turns, but there's no rounds, and everything just kind of flows into the next turn until the game ends. Like, right. The game starts, and then you do the same thing, basically, for however many turns, and then the game ends. There's no, like, pauses or you know, shifts in what a turn means. There's no, like, out-of-turn actions that have to happen at the end of rounds. There's no cleanup or repopulating or...
Right.
Just not a lot of, like board keeping to do.
Right, its mechanics allow it to circumvent the sort of downtime that a lot of worker placement games have. Mm-hmm. Since you don't have a phase where you take back workers, that's just part of like the game itself. It's very fast paced.
Or I wouldn't say fast paced per sure. se, but it's paced
evenly,
very maybe. Evenly. Yeah, it's steady for sure.
Yeah,
I think this game has a very clever balance. That it strikes with the number of workers, the number of spaces on the board, the functions of these spaces, the costs of buildings, and the cost of advancing the cathedral, and the function of the money resource, which all balances out to make a game that feels like it goes at a good pace, at a good steady pace. It feels like your workers are never too scarce or too readily available. It definitely strikes a well-intentioned balance between those two things, and the resources similarly never feel too scarce or too abundant in this game. It always feels like just with so many elements, like how many workers any player has at any point in the game, and how efficient each worker is on any given space, which you know is directly related to how much it costs to perform other actions like build buildings. The game just strikes this. Really delicate balance, which I think is perfect. It's like it never feels like you're running out of resources, or you know, sometimes you'll just be a couple resources short, but you're never one or two turns away from getting what you need. And yeah, at any given point, other than the start of the game, it doesn't feel like you have too many or too few workers.
Yeah,
and at least if you do have too many or too few, you know why.
Right. I feel like you could probably actually math out the math they use in this game.
For sure.
Be like, how many workers need to be spent to pay for a building? You know, how many turns is it to pay for a building? Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they I'm sure they did a ton of testing and math to figure it out, but they did, and that's why the game feels... I think that plus the steady nature of the way that the game's turns work... makes the game feel like it's always at a good pace, at a good level of tension. Let's see.
Do we just talk about board flow?
There was one other point
flow
I wanted to make. I do want to talk about how the interaction and especially, I mean, the way that the town center and the jail works makes it so that between turns, no matter how many players are playing the game, the board state can change in pretty interesting ways and therefore adjust like what your strategy is from turn to turn. I think that's important in a game like this, that like not only is there interaction, but that interaction is very meaningful. So on when it comes back around to your turn, a number of things could have happened. Like a player could have placed their fourth worker on a space, which incentivizes you to take them. Or a player could have taken your pieces off of a space, which makes you reconsider which resources you're focusing on at the time. Or a player could have deposited some of your workers into jail, and that makes you consider whether you need to take them back. Or a player could have played a worker onto the black market, which might make you worried that the black market's about to reset. Or a player could have played a worker on the guild hall, which makes you worried that the guild hall might run out too soon, or that the black market might reset from that as well. Or a player may have advanced on the cathedral, which makes you consider whether you need to start advancing on the cathedral. So even though you know, the general personal strategy on like a single player basis is like, I need to collect the resources that I need to advance on the cathedral or build a building. And that's like as simple as it gets. The turn to turn choices that you make can be so varied and can change so much from turn to turn based on what other players are doing. And I think that's incredible in a game that has like no first come first serve mechanic that a worker placement game normally would have.
Right. It makes workers surprisingly meaningful. And I do want to mention that this doesn't really kick in until turn four or so, which means that there is still that sort of beginner early grace period where sure, everybody's kind of feeling out the game, and then it starts to pick up. And then because the black market doesn't reset on the guild hall until the end, it really builds an intensity towards the end of the game. It has a nice curve of like significance or like tension, desperation.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a little curve motion with my hand. I know you can't see it.
I can picture it.
Okay. So
yeah.
Yeah. Board flow.
Let's talk about board layout. Flow.
This board is incredible.
Incredibly well laid out. Okay. Let me just break it down. All right. So on the far left side, you have the virtue tracker. Beside the virtue tracker are the most relevant spaces for the virtue tracker, which are the guild hall, which by proxy is the cathedral, the tax stand, and the black market. All right. So the most important virtue related spaces, other than the jail, but we'll get to that, are on the far left side, right next to the virtue tracker. And by the way, the cathedral is near the top of the virtue tracker and the black market's near the bottom. So first off, great placement there. So not only is there a tracker on the edge of the board, but it makes sense where it is, which is very nice.
Yes. And everything that reacts to it is next to it. So you can very quickly make judgments on whether it's useful or not.
Right. Okay, the jail is on the very opposite corner of the black market, which makes a lot of sense to me. It's like the opposite of what the black market is on the opposite side of the board. And when the black market resets, I don't know, there's something about carrying those three workers all the way over to the other side of the board that sort of tickles me.
It's like you're actually going to jail.
Yeah, and also, not to mention, it sort of adds a little bit of obscured information that you may not consider how many workers are about to enter the jail from the black market when the black market resets because they're so far away. I think that adds a little bit of surprise and tension to that situation.
Right.
Basic resources are in the center of the board.
Right. And also in the center of the board is the town center. So not only is that thematically coherent, but it means that if you're looking at the town center, you're most likely also looking at the four or the three spaces that will have the most workers or are most likely to have the most workers.
Right.
Additionally, since the town center is in the center of the board, it's almost always in view, meaning it's always kind of a reminder that's like, this is a way you can interact with the board.
Right.
And it's easy to compare the town center to, you know, any other spaces as well, since you just kind of make a smaller eye movement. There are four focal points in each corner, or one in each corner. So guardhouse, guild hall, black market, and regular market. These are the four workshop. Most. Yeah, these are the four most mechanically unique spots of the board, and so they're each given their own corner. The king's storehouse, though, is also kind of mechanically unique, but in the middle.
Well, the king's storehouse has to do with virtue. Right. So it's near the virtue tracker. It's beside the tax stand. So there's that. But it also has to deal with luxury resources. So it's situated between the tax stand and the silversmith. The silversmith, which is the edge of the basic resource zone.
Right. The top action on the king's storehouse is the virtue one. The bottom one is the luxury resource one. And you can only get marble from the king's storehouse and the black market, which are kind of adjacent.
Yeah, they do put both marble acquisition locations near each other.
There's the fact that the building deck is between the black market and the regular market. So both ways to get buildings are next to each other. And that is opposite the cathedral where you're spending buildings. So like they're kind of separated.
The assistants are on the bottom edge of the board. So is the black market, which is the other place where you can get assistants. So assistants are just sort of delegated to the bottom edge of the board, which is kind of makes sense because the points are more situated to the top of the board, I guess.
Right. Guild hall, chapel, debt.
Luxury resources.
Yeah, it's really well put together.
Also, I guess there's another thing that like on the right side, you pile up a bunch of workers in the jail. And on the left side, you pile up a bunch of money in the tax stand. And so it sort of separates where these piles accrue.
Yeah, and you pile up a bunch of workers in the guild hall. The guild hall and guard house have the same letters for their initials, which is kind of funny. I just realized that. Also, since the tax, like, not only is the tax collection next to the virtue tracker because it deals with virtue, but because it costs virtue, and so it is there because it's easier to weigh that choice there. Much like the black market. The four actions of the guard station are ordered in pretty much order of operations.
Yes.
Like you're probably going to be selling before you take your workers back.
That's intentional, because not only is it like the logical process that a player should expect to use the guardhouse or is it called the guardhouse?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the guardhouse. But when you play the versus bot mode, the single player or two player with a bot version of this game, with the automaton deck, it follows those steps in that order. So very intentional.
Yes.
I want to say, by the way, at this point that I have played, I played a two player game versus the bot, and it's okay. I think the bot functions a little odd because it can't make decisions like a player would. It just kind of follows an order of operations for its actions. And the bot doesn't acquire resources or spend resources to build buildings, except most of its actions acquire marble. So essentially, rather than like building buildings, it just progresses on the virtue track, it progresses on the cathedral track, and then it acquires bonus points from marble. And that's what you're competing against. But it's a little frustrating because its pieces don't pile up in a logical way. It steals your pieces from the board at really unfortunate, illogical times. So it's functional, but it's a little frustrating just because it doesn't have that like strategic logic to it.
Yeah. I don't have anything else to say, really.
The reverse sides for the characters are pretty cool, but I'd like to probably play some more games with them to get an idea of whether they have such a huge bearing on what you do. I didn't feel that my character's reverse side, which had the most virtue but didn't start with many resources, I think it started with an extra building card, but it had zero silver and zero other resources to begin with. It didn't really give me like a clear direction, and its bonus ability was just kind of a slight bonus. It didn't really point me in the direction I should go for that game. I think the game is perfectly fine without those other sides, just playing the normal way.
Yeah. I mean, the normal game is very well put together.
I think Yeah, I would highly recommend this game, especially if you're a fan of worker placements and you want to play something that shakes up the genre. Or if you're not a fan of worker placements and you want to try something that is sort of like an anti-worker placement game.
Yeah, it's more forgiving.
Yes. All right. And I guess with that, that ends our discussion on Architects of the Western Kingdom. Or, sorry, Architects of the West Kingdom. Thank you for listening.
See you later.
See ya.